Hello and welcome to In the Motherhood, March 19th, 2008, CKUT. That song you just heard was I Love Playing with Fire by The Runaways. Today we are going to talk about a few different things. One of the things we're going to talk about is a book called The Glass Castle Memoirs by Jeanette Walls. And we have special guests today. Layla and Dominique is here too. She's here every week. Oh, she's here every show with us. She's our tech person. But she read the book too, so she's going to be part of the show today in a more verbal way than previous shows. The tone of the book, it is a book, it's a memoir, it's not a novel, and it's about a girl growing up with her family, and her parents are kind of eccentric. She grows up in very challenging circumstances, and the tone of the book brings up a lot of issues surrounding parental neglect and the impact that has on a child and the fine line that exists sometimes between freedom and neglect. So we're going to talk a bit about that, and then at the end of the show we're going to finish up with some interesting resources around town that parents might like to know about. The Glass Castle is a book that when was our book club?
It was in February.
So we had talked about having a book club, and partially as an excuse to get a bunch of people together in the dead of winter and get out of the house a bit. We're all mothers, we're all parents, and so maybe disproportionately we spend more time at home in our little boxes than we do going out and meeting people, especially at night and social things. So it was kind of partially an excuse to get together with some other people, and of course we want to elevate our minds by reading. And so I chose this book, and I bought a bunch of friends copies for Christmas presents, and we read the book, and then more people wanted to join the book group, and the group grew to, I don't know how many people, Rona, were at the,
oh, I would say maybe,
is there about a dozen
10 or
15?
Yeah,
15 people ended up crowding into somebody's living room to discuss the book, and we ended up talking about it for 5 hours because it brought up a lot, like I said, a lot of different issues, and people could really offer their personal perspectives on it. But I forgot to introduce everybody. I'm Trixie, and we'll go around the table. We'll start with you this time.
Hi, I'm Dominique.
I'm Sonia. I'm a mother of two young boys.
Rona, I have two kids, a girl and a boy.
Layla, I have one kid, a girl.
Great. So do you have any perspective on anything?
Anything? You know what I liked about the book club was when I read it, I mean, everyone has their negative and positive memories of childhood, but I mean, I had a basically okay childhood. And then when I started to hear some stories where some of the readers felt like, they actually lived what the book was talking about, what her memoir was. And then I started to be like, wow, it's just not just an opinion about what you think of the book. These women actually lived a childhood like that and now have children and are trying to change things for their children. Found that the most interesting.
We're getting some crazy feedback here. Is there something I can do to make it stop? It's like a swarm of bees or something. But the book, what people, it's kind of hard to discuss a book. I had thought maybe when we're going to do the show that I would read excerpts of the book, but I realized that could get kind of long-winded. But it's hard to discuss a book and try and for people who haven't read the book to understand what it's about. So can we just say basically the book is about a girl growing up, she has two sisters and a brother, and she has parents who are kind of, at the beginning of the book, they start off, and this is my perspective, feel free to jump in, they start off, and you're kind of looking at them, they're creative, artistic, zany. I'm a homeschooling parent, so there was like a home education aspect of it, and I thought, wow, that's really cool, they're sharing this kind of interesting life with their kids. And even though the beginning of the book starts off with a very kind of profound scenario, you kind of still at the beginning of the book think maybe the parents are just these eccentric, interesting parents. But over the course of the book, and I'm not ruining anything for anybody, I hope, but it kind of deteriorates and you wonder about their mental health and the choices that they're making and the negative impact it's having on the kids. But There's a lot of different scenarios in the book, but what was the most shocking thing
for
you? Well,
for me, I didn't see them as deteriorating or revealing mental illness symptoms. I saw actually the neglect issue and the abuse coming from the society that does not allow someone who wants to build a different life, an artistic, maybe a hunter-gatherer style of living. That's what the parents were originally attempting to do. And it is so unforgiving of difference. It's brutally unforgiving. And so in a way, the parents just succumb, and the whole family, at the beginning of the book, they start off feeling independent and sure of themselves, confident. And when they end up in Virginia, in West Virginia, they end up feeling poor, second rate. It's cold. It's not like the desert where they could be running around and being independent. They're poor, but they have their dignity. So in a way, the issue of neglect I found is that the society is unforgiving of difference, of artistic endeavor. And the shattered dreams, perhaps the glass castle represents that.
Yeah, the glass castle is just like, that's exactly what that is. But at the same time, there, and I agree with you, and at the book club that we had, there was a debate, a gentle debate about whether the mother specifically was mentally ill and the father was kind of written off in as kind of like an alcoholic, and his disease was affecting the choices that he made and the outcomes that happened because of those choices. But there was a great debate about whether or not, and I think you'd left at that point, Sonia, because you had to go home to your kids, but was the mother mentally ill? And you're saying that society is unforgiving. And I totally, that's how I felt at the beginning of the book, was that they were just very different and making different choices. And they were forced to they were claustrophobic, living within the constraints that society had constructed. But then there were other things, like when they locked the kids in the back of the truck, they're going on this long trip, moving from, were they in New Mexico at that point, to Virginia? And they, rented a truck, and with the new baby, put all the kids in the back of this big truck and took the long route there, the scenic route.
And she called it an adventure. She said, you're lucky to be in the back. And then they closed it up. They said, but you have to be very quiet for the next 14 hours.
14 hours locked in the back of a truck. And with, I think, no food or water or anything.
And a new baby.
And a brand new baby who was crying. And the parents aren't taking even the most direct route there, but they're taking the scenic route. So that
which
they
only
can,
they can see.
Yeah, which only they can see from...
But being locked up in schools every single day of your life with no venue for escape. I mean, 14 hours seems dismal in comparison.
Well, no, I agree with, you know me, I'm radical in schooler. I agree with that. But would that be called like a sane or reasonable choice, or would it be called, I'm not really asking you, I'm just posing a general question, would that be, what do you think, Dominique? Do you remember that part of the story?
I do.
Were you appalled, or were you like, whoa, that's weird, or...
I was appalled a little bit, because that is no longer a creative adventure. It becomes not being aware of your child's physical needs. They had to go to the bathroom, they were thirsty, but they just were oblivious because they were taking the scenic route or whatever. And yeah, I did not think that was cool.
It's sort of like when you're poor, you're not supposed to enjoy it. You're not supposed to take the scenic route, because then you would understand it if it's, okay, it's an emergency because they're poor and they're trying to get out of their poverty. It's sort of condemning them for enjoying their poverty in a way. Did they have
many other options in their situation. Well, yes, they had the option to give up their dreams earlier, ship off the kids in safe buses to school. And we've seen, you know, her episode when she ends up going to school and she's constantly bullied by teachers, by the principal, by the kids, by the hooligans, by the good kids. It's sort of like a very bullying society that is just tearing on this land and leaves dreamers no way to run around free. So in a way, they end up like criminals. I mean, society did make them into criminals. Yes, there are issues. I wouldn't put my kid in the back of the truck now. But, I mean, I don't know in their situation, what would I have preferred?
I'm really glad you came today, because whenever I ever talk to you, it's always food for thought. I don't think I've ever had a conversation with you that isn't food for thought. And I think I get what you're saying. At the same time, the way this particular part of the story goes down is the baby is quite new. They have three older kids, and then they have a baby. And so they charge one of the daughters with the responsibility and don't, you know, make sure the baby doesn't cry and keep quiet in the back. But why couldn't the mother have just like held, if what's more dangerous, holding the baby on your lap and breastfeeding your baby on this 14-hour trip, or leaving it locked in the back of the truck? At that point, there were points in the story where I felt that's just a selfish act. That's,
well,
like,
I grew up in a in different societies. They're tricksies.
Tell me more.
Luring me into my personal confessions. I'll write my own memoir.
Exactly.
But I grew up in different societies, some of them traditional, some of them not traditional. I mean, I come from a background of intellectual parents and grandparents pursuing their dreams, not always successfully, some mm-hmm. more successfully than others. But what I found also, it's the context. And the context, for example, that I remember growing up in the first 5 years of my childhood, spending in a tiny little village in the countryside of the Moscow region. 15 houses. People had their little farms. There was a communal farming co-op for the state. I never felt they were poor. I never perceived myself as poor. Mm-hmm. Everyone always had the support of the community. Kids always had something to eat, even in, you know, winter when all the half the year the village was blocked. There were no roads. If kids were delivered in winter, they were delivered in the village at homes. And there's always... Kids were taking care of kids. Mm-hmm. Adults were working in winter less than in the summer. In the summer, everyone was working. And it was, like, for me, it didn't shock me, because kids took care of kids. There was always someone present. They weren't alone. What I found shocking and horrendous was that this family was so alone.
Right.
The solitude. I mean, in the end, yes, perhaps they did go mad, but you know what? It's this incredible alienation and solitude from any resources.
I think my perspective of the book, though, is that in a sense, the parents didn't seek community. What you're describing in your tiny village sounds like the whole "it takes a village" mentality, which I think we all wish was how things were. In this book, I felt that the parents held themselves above people. In their way was better, and they didn't really seek out the community of even other artists. And when they finally went to Virginia, and once again, I don't know how interesting this is for somebody who hasn't read the book, but we all have, so let's just talk. But it is that when they finally went to Virginia, the mother was actually excited there were no other artists there, because she was going to be like the artist in town, you know? So...
Yeah, I think the difference is what you're describing sounds like everyone worked together, and children taking care of children. It's fine. There's always someone around, maybe a grandmother or something. But these people And they had food. They would make sure you prepared for winter, that you weren't going to have much food, so you prepared for that. But in this case, it seemed like the children going without food or rotting food or, you know, to me, in North America, where you have so many choices of getting food for your children, they didn't even attempt to take any of those actions. That was surprising.
For me, the moment that really shocked me was when the kids are hungry and they're cold and the mother is sneaking chocolate.
Oh, I love that part.
I was horrified. Explain
that. Just, if you can flesh that out a little bit so people...
Well, I don't remember the details
I'll tell it. The cupboards were bare, basically. Everybody was going hungry. The kids were like, you know, getting thinner and thinner and their clothes were hanging off of them. Maybe I'm embellishing, but that's how evocative it was for me. But mysteriously, the mother was getting plumper and plumper in the book. And then finally, one of the kids, I think, looked over and saw her kind of chewing something and rustling under the blankets. And she'd been like hoarding and eating like those big, huge family-sized chocolate bars while the kids were hungry. Okay, but Leila, I think I understand. I appreciate the spirit. You're talking more about the spirit of this, because it's like I invite you to give a response and I'm like, well, actually it's not that at all. So I don't mean to get like that, because I really appreciate your perspective on this too.
I appreciate yours.
Thank you. Okay, let's hug.
I mean, but I'm surprised that you guys think it's so easy to get access to food in North America, and I know a lot of people don't. Actually, I know families in Quebec here who in the summer have to steal electricity because they don't have any heating, and they have to, the only water, hot water that they get, mm-hmm. is they plug in into some wires with really dangerous equipment to melt ice, well, snow. They melt the snow and then they have a little bit of hot water. And they try to go to food bank, but food bank requires, you know, state papers and, you know, like...
And often...
Or welfare or whatever. If you're not on welfare, then you can't get it.
And often the food bank has hours to... This is very a pertinent point, because often the food banks too have hours where the food is available, but you're not available to be there, or you don't have the bus fare to get there or to drag your kids there.
Yes.
To the food banks. And I was just reading
in the States it's even harsher.
No, that's a good point, because their food is pretty accessible, but if you run out of money, you run out of money. So
it seems like it's it strikes on all the aspects of your life and your functional social aspects, talents, I guess. It kind of in the end what I saw them as just getting into despair, mm-hmm. and maybe that's what, you know, what to someone who is not cut out from participating in the resources, it would look like a disability, mental disability, social disability, whatever. But I found it to be a symptomatic kind of an unforgiving aspect of a society that does not tolerate a different way of living or a different... just people's rights to access resources, to plant your own food, you know, land or anything.
I found that
Russia, Africa, you can still go and hunt. Here, it's all privatized.
Provigoized.
The kids in this story tried to budget their money, tried to make their lives better in so many ways, and it seemed to me that the parents were, you know, regardless of what society was doing around them, I didn't see them working with the family for the family. Another shocking moment for me was when they found a diamond ring, again, hungry and cold, and the mother said, "It's time I do something for me," which she says a lot in this book. "It's time I do something for me. I'm going to wear this ring. This ring is my gift for myself." While her kids are, I can't understand that.
She would sell the ring. They found a diamond ring in the mud in their small Virginia town and anticipated... that
food for a year, let's
yeah,
say.
Yeah, that she would like pawn the ring and they would eat, but she decided to keep the ring.
She said it would improve her self-esteem.
Well, in a way, it's all, yes, it revolves around food, and I understand, I mean, you do get again, in this context, one does end up getting obsessed with food. I never found anything in the life story that would give them a chance to really solve the problem. So, you know, these little things like the chocolate or the ring, they're not solutions. Mm-hmm. They're not solutions that would make their dreams come true. And I found this culture sort of doesn't value one's own perception of one's role. So if one is an artist, in a way it's taking that, well, if you're not a commercial artist, then you deserve to be poor and poverty. I found a lot of issues of blame, actually, in the book, because, and not only in the book, it's society. If you're poor, it's your fault. You're to blame. You're guilty.
We live in a very bootstrap culture. Mm-hmm. Pull yourself up by your bootstraps. Anybody can get a job. And
what kind of jobs? Yeah.
No, I totally understand what you're getting at with that. And that's really pervasive in the book, too. At the same time, when they do have opportunities to work, it's not in their field. The mother's trained to work as a teacher, and she reluctantly, at one point in the book, decides to go back to work, and the kids basically force her to go to work, and she kind of stamps her feet, but she goes because the father's taken off and spent all their money on alcohol.
And she gets a depression because for her it's giving up.
It's giving up on her art.
On her art. She's an artist and she can't do that if she's teaching, and she can't. She can't get up in the mornings, and she's describing symptoms of really deep depression and disappointment.
And we did a radio show a few months back about women in art and how there's so few examples of women throughout history who were both able to be effectively a parent and an artist at the same time, because it's usually women who are called upon to sacrifice mm-hmm. so much for art. And I guess a lot of the suffering in the book from the kids, there was suffering caused by financial deprivation, either when the parents couldn't work, didn't work, or spent all their money on other things, mostly the father spending on alcohol, because there were times when he was working and was he getting food vouchers or something, and everybody was happy and they were reading books, and when there was a financial flush time, then it seemed everybody got along and everything went quite swimmingly. But then poverty kind of put everybody into a tailspin that they couldn't get out of. And this is a pertinent point too, is that even in our culture, in our society, once you get poor, it's a lot easier to get poorer than it is to improve your circumstances.
And also the other aspect I was glad she raised in the book is how, well, that's the unschooling aspect of the book, of their upbringing, is how much they learned without any lessons. Well, just, you know, playing with the parents, the mother taught them something. I mean, I found that the parents gave them something so valuable that no money, I mean, it's horrible that kids go hungry, and it's tragic that they felt so alienated. Mm-hmm. But yet they got something that most other kids don't get, which is the spirit of togetherness with the family, of compassion. The kids always understood, well, at least the author, Jeanette, always understood and valued her father's dreams. And everybody else, even sometimes
until the point that she stopped believing in them. And I'm going to just give the whole book away, because if you haven't read it by now, it's too late. Just plug your ears for a few minutes. Is the glass castle is the father has these plans, these almost, are they architectural type plans about this glass castle that he's going to build, and they're all going to live in it and they'll live happily ever after, and the glass castle just never materializes in the book. And there's one point in the book where the author is ready to leave town. She's leaving her family finally. She's going to go start over in New York, where her older sister has gone ahead of her, and she's leaving the father behind, and she's always been the one with the most special bond with the father. And so he pulls out for the first time in a long time these plans for the glass castle to show her, like, I'm going to put your room here and it's going to be great and it's going to happen. And she's lost all belief in his dreams at that point. She doesn't really believe in him anymore and what he could create, or...
Which is the tragic part, that's that in a way she succumbs to the massive peer pressure.
You're so I love that you're so 180 and the rest of us are sitting here going what peer pressure?
It's
her father disappointed her, let her down over and over again. There's a part in the book where he practically pimps her out,
but he would have never ever built the glass castle had he gone on working in the mine. They would have all died from lung cancer.
But he asked his whole family to believe in his dream and invest in his dream for all those years, and gave so little in return. And even to the
point, so little? She went. They went to New York, and she did what she really believed in, and she got herself a life she believed in. So, I mean, I don't look at it as totally. I mean, I don't want to trivialize the suffering, mm-hmm. but on the other hand, in their situation, there was so little to choose from, mm-hmm. from the menu. And they just opted on the dream and the character and the love and the compassion. And that's what made her a wonderful person and successful person. So in a way...
Well, I don't know if that's what made her a wonderful person or a successful person. I mean, all of our experiences add up to who we are and everything. But I think that parents are responsible for providing... We have children and take on the responsibility, in my mind, to provide them with the tools and everything they need. And they certainly, the parents in this book, certainly provided the children with some very unique tools that became really pertinent in the lives that they crafted for themselves later.
Like the binary system, for example, the schooling issues I found really interesting.
Well, tell us a bit about...
The father always... he was the mother was the artist, and he was the scientist, the mathematician, mm-hmm. the physician. And he always told her to take the harder... Well, first of all, that there are different ways of even doing math. That it's not only the math system that we have here. There's binary system. There were different, I think, the 8 system. He made her do the homework, the normal homework, in the more difficult binary system, and then she would have to redo it in the simpler way to mm-hmm. give it to the teacher. And the teacher, one day she didn't have the time to redo it, so she just gave the bin, and the teacher looked at it and she thought it was a joke, making fun of her. And she's like, no, because she knew more than the teacher. Mm-hmm. So in a way, he gave her the tools to... even on science, on school education, that inadvertently she did apply later to her success.
I love you so much.
Thank you, me too. I love me and you.
I love us all. At the same time, I know that you're an amazing person. I know that you give your daughter amazing tools. She's a sensational child. She's very interesting. You give her amazing tools and perspectives and ways of looking at the world, but you also give her so much love and encouragement, and you feed her, and she wears warm clothes in the winter, and all of those things. That if you were like the father in the book, how do you think that culture and society would respond to that? How would you respond if the kid next door was had a really brilliant father, but...
Well, I wouldn't stay probably here that long to be in this situation. But, I mean, seeing that there's democracy spreading all over the planet, I don't see much, many options where to go. But, I mean, so far, we did have periods when we didn't have apartments and we went traveling. So in a way, I do identify with these parents. Mm-hmm. And we enjoyed it.
See, I identify and it
pissed
with them too.
It pissed people off because, well, you know, you're not supposed to enjoy it. You're supposed to be responsible and get any jobs. And I didn't see, like, me working, you know, my husband cleaning, you know, some floor at the supermarket, and me working as a cashier there would have... that would have been neglect.
No, I agree. I agree with that, but at the same time, your daughter has so much love and confidence and assurance.
Well, I also felt this family had a lot of love. Yes, in the end, they did succumb, like I say, to this reality, but, I mean, when you look at it, like, the first more than half of the book, there's support, compassion, and belief. And I think that's...
We have to let Sonia
yes,
okay, from my perspective, the father does, I mean, even though he's an alcoholic and has lots of big problems and is disappointing to the family and everything, spending their money and whatever on alcohol, I did see him as being involved with his kids, interested in his kids. One of the touching moments was that when the author goes to New York and ends up studying at college, and he goes to the library and reads all her textbooks with her in case she has a question, because he's a really sort of egomaniacal kind of guy who thinks he's, you know, the answer to everybody's problems in a way. But from him, I did have some sympathy, and I did have, I did see some positive virtues and whatever. From the mother, I didn't see her having interest in her children. I didn't see love coming for her children, or compassion, or really caring of on a. That's neglect to me. I mean, I would have labeled her as neglectful to her children because it was a basic lack of caring. And I don't have any examples in the book that come out that say to me she cared about her children.
Oh, there was the Christmas where she went with them to get all they're finally at one point settled in the book, and you have really high hopes for everything turning out nicely for them all. And they've come into a bit of money, and they've inherited a home to stay in. Oh, I have to get to this part too. But the mother goes out and makes a very special Christmas, because usually they don't have a more kind of traditional North American Christmas. But also, and this is plug your ears if you're planning on reading The Glass Castle, but it, as it turns out at the end, the mother this whole time has held $1 million property she's had that she inherited, and the whole time that they're all suffering and living in degradation, because they're living in a house that's falling down and the roof is leaking on their bed and they're covering themselves up with tarps and nobody gives a damn. But the whole time she's got all this cash stashed.
That's what I was saying before, when I was like, I love, you know, the adventure part of the book, being artists, being mathematicians and creative, that's great. But they did have a means of having a bit more money, and they chose that route. Their kids didn't even, there wasn't even a bathroom in one of their houses. So I think they kind of forced their children to follow their dreams, which at some point when your kids are little and they think they idolize you, you can get your kids to do anything, basically, because they think you're great. And at one point your kids are older and start to go more towards being adults themselves. And I think that's the risk they took, where their kids kind of abandoned them because the parents' dreams weren't their dreams.
Well, there's a point in the book when the author asked about flies. Asked the mother, and well, there's several moments in the book when the mother really tells them, and the father confirms, that what you should really value is self-sufficiency, independence, sort of the detachment from material things, independence from them, which is particularly, I mean, I found it particularly interesting in this over-dependent culture, you know, and all these gadgets and,
no, you're right,
and conformity, and so they're completely unconformist. And she explained, for example, even with the cats, the Jeanette, when she was a kid, she asks, how come we don't get cat food for all these cats that we save? And the mother said, well, you know, you can't get them dependent on you. We'll do them a disservice. Mm-hmm. They have to be wild. They'll be happier wild. What if you have to leave? But even if. And then she asks her, well, how about, you know, killing, you know, there are all these flies and all the other families. They're also poor, but, you know, still they, you know, they get these poisonous things.
Flood paper or whatever.
Yeah, to kill the flies. And the mother said, well, that would disturb everyone's self-sufficiency, independence, because lizards eat the flies and someone else eats the lizards and someone else eats whoever eats the lizards. And finally it comes to the cats and the dogs and the coyotes, and we're all part of it, and that's what we should value. And that, yes, they in a way they kind of end up being the losers, but I found it great that Jeanette never really judges them, and she accepts the gift of this self-sufficiency and valuing, respecting all life with, you know, not overvaluing one species over the other. I mean, I found that very interesting and courageous that to the end, the parents sort of stayed with those values.
They really did stay with it. I mean, the mother at the end comes off a bit as like an activist when they're all mm-hmm. all living in New York, and she's squatting in a tenement, and then she ends up winning the right to purchase it from the city, and she has her values and she stays true to her values the whole time. But it's just I have a hard time wrapping my head around that this is somehow fortunate for the children to be saddled with parents like this.
Again, because I'm judgmental of the mother, I'm a judgmental person. It's a bit of a problem. But, you know, her talking about, you know, what doesn't kill you makes you stronger. And, you know, if your eyes are weak, you should not wear glasses because weak eyes need exercise. They don't need glasses. And these are, you know, these were her values. These were her beliefs. And, I mean, they were consistent throughout the book. I could see that. But I often took it to be her telling herself a story so that she looked like a good guy. Because truthfully, again, I did not see a lot of evidence that she really cared about her kids. I found her to be caring about herself. And I judge that.
Their take on, yes, on medicine is also controversial by these standards. But again, my parents were against medical intervention unless it was like, okay, you know, got bitten by a rabid monkey or a dog. I got the anti-rabies shot. But overall, you know, I had malaria. I didn't get medicine. I had it several times, and each time it, you know, just kind of the last serious time I had, I was ill for 2 or 3 days. You know, usually you're ill. First time was mm-hmm. 2 weeks, really hard. Because, well, you know, if you get too much antibiotics, it's worse for you. So it's a disservice. So in a way, yes, you could look at it as neglect. But on the other hand, there's strong evidence that perhaps overusing you know, all this medication is abuse.
Well, this is why we talked at our book club. We talked for the book about the book for 5 hours because there's a lot of fine lines in this book too. And one of the things I read in an interview with the author that isn't in the book, because I was trying to find photos of her as a child to get kind of like, who was this gangly little girl? She describes herself as you know, tall and skinny, red hair, freckles, like the whole shebang. But she said in an interview, there's no photos of her or her siblings as children, yet there's thousands of photos of her mother's paintings. And I thought, okay, like, this is... And I don't know. And I really appreciate your perspective, and I don't even want to debate your perspective, because I see the value in not even the value in what you're saying. I see the pertinence in what you're saying, and I see how it applies to this story. But as a mother, I'm like, who are these people? It's like...
She also describes her mother as a teacher, where the mom as a teacher is hugging the students and telling them how wonderful they are. But I don't think ever in the book we read that she hugged her children. Well, she doesn't say it.
Yeah, I was thinking of that with the flies and whatnot too, and the cats, that the mother was really for the underdog and really generous in a way with her love for a lot of people outside of her kids. But for her kids, it was like she was like, you have to be tough, you have to be self-sufficient. She did value self-sufficiency, but it for me, it didn't come off as a gift.
And self-esteem, because when there was this kid that was really annoying, who appeared in one of the cities and where they stayed a bit longer than often. And the mother said, told Jeanette, well, you know, you should be his friend because, look, you know, you shouldn't be proud because you're so much more fortunate.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so in a way, she also gave them the self-esteem and self-respect that gave them the power. I mean, I'm not saying that this is ideal. I mean, obviously, there were... well, every person is human, and we all have our, you know, drawbacks. But what I'm saying is that I saw it more as a social symptom than the abuse and neglect of the parents, that in this, that society is so selfish and it does value selfishness, that in a way it's very difficult, like, for them even to find, like you said, you know, finding a community of artists. Right. It's an individualist society and you have to have a specific role and play it and quietly.
Well, I wanted to read something that I got off the internets. It's a statement of Anita Weinberg. She's the staff attorney at the Children's Rights Project, Legal Assistance Foundation of Chicago. And she says, an extraordinarily small percentage of parents set out to harm their children. An overwhelming percent are accused of neglect, not abuse. It occurs because the parent is overwhelmed with responsibility, with poverty, lacks support networks, knowledge of how to parent, how to manage crises, and where to turn for help. I know we are not looking for excuses for why the abuse and neglect occurs, but when thinking about what is best for the child and what is in a child's best interest, we have to look at what led to the abuse or neglect and what we can do about it, which I think is what you're talking about entirely, is that the parents didn't have the, they had chosen a life that is, has an element of nobility to it, and choosing and following their dream, and which, I mean, is really the only real way to live, in my opinion, is to like decide what you want and to go after it. But it seems like they didn't want their kids. Like they, the kids weren't
part of the plan.
Also, there's a part in the book that we haven't discussed. First of all, I find the dad being an alcoholic is definitely a problem that does not have an easy solution. And then, besides the food, you know, lack of food and hygiene, I found there are many parts in the stories, and I don't want to give things away, but where there's like cases of molestation and the parents not really doing anything about it and saying, well,
she feels sorry for the uncle that comes on to her daughter. She doesn't feel sorry for her daughter.
So certain parts like that where you're like,
I thought about that, yes, but I mean, that's something, again, it's it's a cultural take on how victimized you're going to have your daughter feel about some, you know, indecent guy. I mean, in most cultures around the world, well, you know, there are freaks. It's no big deal. Just don't let him touch you. And that's what she tells her her daughter. Well, it's your take. And she asks her, how do you feel about, do you feel harmed? And she said, no. It was disgusting. She's like, well, then you're not a victim. You know, don't be a victim. Mm-hmm. And just don't let it happen. And I found it healthy. I mean, you know, issues of rape is something, it's a social issue. Mm-hmm. I mean, you can be raped. I mean, just like the, I find, you know, the fact that the mother didn't fulfill her dreams. I mean, that's rape in a way. Her mother forced her to have this backup degree in education. So when she goes to teach, I mean, she feels raped by her mother, by society, that there she has to give it up and prove them right. That this, that pursuing your dreams, if they're not in tune with the whole social spectrum, is wrong. And you're a loser. And she felt raped. But she still didn't succumb to feeling victimized by it. So, I mean, it has its pros and cons, but, hey, in Serbo-Croatian languages, there's even no word for rape. It doesn't mean they dislike, you know, abusive men obscenely undressing themselves or touching, but it's a different take, I guess, on the victimization aspect of things.
Well, that's very heavy. And I see what you're talking about. I see what you're talking in the perspective of the mother and how she's kind of managing her life and the choices that she's making. And
but I can say that in general I agree with a lot of what you're saying, but it's like in the particulars of this book I hold some negative feelings towards the mother in her actions. But in general, I would agree that our society leans toward being overprotective of our kids and that it would be a gift to be giving kids more freedom to learn in this world on their own and even, you know, to play with fire and to play with knives. You can learn a lot. And I hope that I, but my thing with my kids, I mean, they're still very young, but what I would want to do is supervise them with a knife. You know, he's 2.5, he can touch a sharp knife, but I'm going to be there. I'm not going to leave in case he pokes an eye out. And when he's older, maybe then he can have his own pocket knife. So it's a question of supporting him until babies do come into this world entirely dependent and entirely with bad judgment. They will jump off a cliff when they're really small. I'm just saying, when they're really small, it depends on the character of your kid as well, for sure. I mean, my 2.5-year-old is a very responsible 2.5-year-old, and I can trust him in a lot of situations, and I do. But and when I was a kid, I was standing on the edge of the roof, and nobody was there telling me don't jump. When, you know, I used my judgment, and I didn't ever jump and break a bone, and, you know, so generally, that's what I'm saying.
But also, I find actually the social norms on child safety and neglect and abuse issues are sort of hypocritical, because it turns out in this specific case, the mother did have some backup money, but in most cases, I mean, nobody cares really that the parents, the working parents, blue-collar parents, nobody values their dreams. Nobody cares that they're underpaid for their effort and work.
That they didn't put themselves out into the culture around them. We're going to have to wrap this up because I want to get to a few announcements and we could probably talk for a few more hours, but there's another show coming up. And we only have basically 7 minutes left to do all the announcements. So let's just wrap it up and say that I really appreciate your perspective, and I don't disagree or agree with anything anybody has said. They're all valid, and it's a very layered kind of experience, but I certainly appreciate, Layla, your perspective on things very much. Not to say that I don't appreciate yours or yours or yours. But.